Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tron. Han, how are you tonight?
I am doing fabulous, Jim. Just absolutely fabulous. Thank you
Excellent.
For asking.
Excellent. Well, we've got another one of our, I guess Han and I call it one of our favorite show topics. And it's basically listening to what you have to say in the way of questions. So, you know, tonight's episode number 47, questions from our listeners. We don't have a specific topic that we're talking about, so this is going to be a wide-ranging question group. It's going to be a little bit of everything, so we're excited about that opportunity. And as always, please feel free to go to our website, email. You can click on the thing right there in the front that says submit your question. And you can very easily get a specific question that you may be wanting to ask, were afraid to ask, didn't want to know that you asked, whatever, you can get it answered. We'll do everything we can do to compile these again and do more and more of these kind of shows to answer those specific questions. So let's just jump into it. I'm going to be selfish, and I'm going to start off first because I think this is I don't want to set the tone for tonight, but at the same time, I think that there is an opportunity to talk about the realities of things, and like our show is, it's straight talk. We don't have an agenda specifically in the sense that all we want to do is provide the best possible answer to the questions you may have. Now, obviously, we feel very strongly that we provide great design service and we'll be able to provide great service to you if you decide to choose us for doing your dental office. And that's what's wonderful. But we also know that not everyone wants to use us. So we at least want to give you the information that's available out there. So here's one from a Dr. Sarah in Virginia. She said, my question has to do with site selection. I'm looking at two different sites for my new dental office. They're both vacant land because I want to do a new build. And one is basically half the price of the other. Now, the one that's half the price is in a, it's not in a very heavily trafficked area, where the other is an extremely heavily traveled road. How do I choose which is the best? Well, what do you say about that, Han?
I would say it depends on the growth surrounding the site, because you have to look at the, you know, look at the long-term basis. Okay. Naturally, I guess the mantra has always been, location, location, location. And the more eyeballs that get to see your office, the better chance of you succeeding, because you want to be seen, you want to be known, and you want to have warm bodies in your chairs every hours of the day. So looking at the site, you should not look at the cost one versus the other, but you have to look at the big pictures. What is the demographic? What is the growth potential? Is it dying, or is it, you know, or is it growing? What is the future activities, growth activities, or development activities that may or may not that may affect your site? For instance, you can be located at a super, super busy intersection, but in 10 years, as population grow, the, you know, the state may, or the city or the state may need to take a chunk of your front yard to make, to widen the road. That would absolutely affect your potential and your, you know, your growth. Okay, so it's not, I don't think it's a, you know, a clean, dry answer, but you got to do your own work and, you know, make sure that everything looks favorable, not just how cheap can I get this parcel of land for, because you can buy a piece of land that's going to die. Jim?
Without a doubt. The crux to that question answer should be just that. Price for the property is not the criteria to make a decision on which is the best site. Han touched on it, and it's very important. You've got to look at what's happening within the general region. Let's say that they're both equal in the sense that there's enough rooftops around, their demographics are great, both of them work in that regard. So you don't have to worry about, well, hey, there's not enough actual physical bodies to be able to maintain or to create a practice. The other part about it, are you starting up a practice, or is this an established practice that you're going to be moving to this new location? That's a big difference. If you have an established practice and you're moving it to a slightly different location, you could look at hopefully taking a majority of those patients and bringing them to your new location. Now, if you're going in and going to build a brand new building in a new location and it's a new practice, then that's a totally different answer, because a new practice needs to maximize their marketing ability to be able to bring in patients as soon as possible and grow as quickly as possible to be able to, you know, create a long living and longevity in your practice. So you have to be able to say, all right, if I'm existing practice and, you know, maybe the cheaper property might be a good possibility because, you know, I'm over here in this retail center and I can't grow anymore and I need, you know, I'm busting at the seams and I want a new place and I'm tired of leasing and all the crap that comes with the landlord who doesn't do the things that they say they're going to do. And I want to have control over my building, my practice, my place. You know, that's a good time to really think about what to do here. And, you know, there's others out there in this business that will talk about all kinds of different things. But the bottom line is it's extremely important to look at where you're at in your practice model. If you're starting out new, be very careful about burying yourself in some place that doesn't have extremely high exposure. Doesn't fit that criteria that we've always talked about. By the bank, by the grocery store, by the gas station, by, you know, close to the school. All those kind of things that make for a high probability of people seeing your building. We're architects. We're designers. We look at the aesthetics of the building. Go back to one of our podcasts that we've talked about, the aesthetics and the first impressions on the building. The building is your marketing tool just as much as all those flyers and all those cable TV and radio spots that you put out there. That building says so much about you, and if no one sees it, what the heck did you spend your money for? So once people have become established patients, then they've already got that criteria set that they're happy with. All right, this is a decent place, and I got great service, I'm going to continue to come back. That's a totally different thing. We're talking about being able to start up a practice and get it going. You need to have everything you can do possibly to be able to bring that patient in. So that cheap off the road site would be the totally wrong answer for that kind of thing. But if you're moving a new place from your old place, then maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea. Han, you were going to say?
I think, Jim, it also depends on the specialty as well. Okay.
Right. If you're a specialist, you know, right.
Yeah. Well, you don't need to have, you know, walk in traffic. One thing that you touch on, and I like to kind of expand on it a little bit. Okay. I think a lot of time, most of the discussion that I get involved in or participate in when they talk about cost of buildings, it's unfortunate a lot of building owners do not look at their building as a marketing tool. You know, they simply look at how cheap can they do their building. And I guess it depends on the location that and what surrounded you. It would be the design of the building have to be appropriate for the environment that you can, you know, the neighborhood you're going to serve. But I do encourage, you know, the listener to think of the aesthetics of the building, the design of the building, and invest in making it more than simply an extension of their house. Okay. And I hope I didn't come out across wrong. When you're successful and you have a nice home and all that stuff, but it's a home. Your office is a commercial building where you provide health services. It shouldn't look like your second home. Okay? Invest in it and make it look like a commercial building that are more than simply a gable roof with shingle and a front door. Right? Jump.
Definitely. Now, one area also that is extremely important when you look at site selection and evaluating two different properties is accessibility. Now, that heavily traveled road might be partially divided. It might be no left turn lane scenarios. Might be you could only get access from down the road at the light, and then you have to, you know, half your patients have to make U-turns. We've dealt with properties like that, haven't we, Han? You know, it's like, you know, you've got to be so careful that you could have a unbelievable traffic count going by your front door, but they can't get to you because of the restrictions and the requirements, because it is about moving traffic and it's not about having access to the properties along that road. So, you know, if you have good access, then a heavily trafficked road is a great thing. But if you have terrible access and only have right ins and right outs and all that kind of stuff, be careful, be forewarned. You got to really think about that. Is that going to turn off a lot of your patients? Do a lot of your patients come from the west? And as they're coming from the west to get to your building, for example, on an east-west road, and they can't make a left-hand turn into your property, and they've got to go down around and make a U-turn and all that kind of wonderful stuff just to get to your property that's on the other side, well, then you should have been on the south side of the road and not the north side of the road, you know, or vice versa. If you're running, you know, if the majority of your patients come from the east, make sure that you're on the, you know, north side of the road and not the south. Just because of that reason, you know, in an east-west scenario, and obviously it holds true in a north-south scenario as well, depending on where they're coming from. So that has to be evaluated. So the short answer to this question is hire an expert. Get someone like us who can really walk through all of it with you to help you make the determination. It's never too early to integrate that kind of experience into this process, because once you've bought that property, you've got two options in front of you. You make it work or you get rid of it. Now, obviously, you know, making it work could be, you know, could be disastrous or could not be disastrous, but, you know, you basically only have those two options. Before you buy the property, you have all kinds of options. You have the ability to be able to look at other properties. You have the ability to be able to evaluate these things. You may even have the ability to negotiate because of some things that are identified that might even reduce the cost of that property. Han, you were going to say something?
Well, I think it in the scenario of buying it, you know, and then trying to figure it out, some of the worst thing that could happen is you buy it with an existing structure that you can't use, like a house.
Yeah.
Okay. So do your homework. Ask a lot of questions. Reach out and find, you know, a design professional that that can hold your hand and help you out. And basically that's my mind. But, you know, the question to the, you know, the answer to the question is it's not about the money. Okay.
Exactly.
Making the right investment. That's what it matters.
Well, hopefully, Dr. Sarah, yep. that gave you some at least insight into where that's going. Han, let me ask you what questions you have on your list.
All right. This is from Dr. Heather from Missouri. On a building project, in terms of authority and responsibility, what are the pecking orders? You want to give it a shot, Jim?
Oh my goodness, that's a good one. We can start out with the number one. We've talked a little bit about this, but obviously the number one person who should be in charge of your project is you. You are in charge of what should be happening, so you need to lead everything that's going on. The second entity in our mind should be the architect. The architect then can facilitate and coordinate with all the other members that are part of the team. Go back to one of our podcasts way back in the beginning. We talked about team building and all those people that are part of the core group and all the extensions. And there are numerous amounts of individuals that sometimes would be part of your team when you're developing a new property. But without a doubt, you as the owner, number one, we're number two, and then number three, everybody else after that. If you go about it a different way, and there's lots of people out there that like to say that. They're saying, no, go hire yourself a general contractor, and let that general contractor then lead the project. We strongly disagree with that. And we have lots of experience in dealing with general contractors, construction managers, project managers, owners' representatives, whatever you want to call them. And there's a lot of good people out there. But at the same time, the best entity is the architect to lead all of that, who directly reports to you, the owner. What do you think about that, Han?
I think it's a great answer, Jim. Let me add a few pieces to that. Okay, the owner, in this case, a lot of the doctors, and they go like, well, why do I, you know, why am I the, you know, at the top of the pecking order? It's not that, you know, what we're saying is that you shouldn't be the one who answer the phone or the questions that pertain to the technical aspect of the project. The reason why you are the, you know, on the top of the pile is because you're the owner. You get to basically guide the team, make important decisions, you know, provide, you know, provide the visions of what you need, and you know, make sure that everybody's accountable for what they are responsible for. Never, okay. Let me say that again. Never put yourself in a situation where you become the technical advisor on the project. Unless you, you know, unless you have spent a number of years in the construction field, running project, and you go, you know what? I'm going to go into dentistry and make more money. Okay, it's rare that we have ran into a few dentists that have had some construction background, but they are rare. Okay, but usually most of our clients have not. So from a more of a management, I didn't say micromanager, I said management side, that's where your leadership is needed. On the technical side, that's where your architects and engineers come in. That's what we're good at. That's what we have been trained to do. So the architects would be the natural, second in command. Okay, then when you get into construction, the contractor work with the team, but by no means are they in charge. Jim?
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you might say, well, that's kind of a different system than what I'm hearing from other groups or other folks who do this kind of work. And it may be. It may be a different system, but we have found historically that this system works, and it works very well. It does a lot of things, but the biggest of which is it helps to maximize the coordination and minimize the issues, the problems, the things that will lead to cost overruns, as one would call it, to delays, those kind of things that all adds to, we call it the stress level. We like to say, let us sweat the details, because that's what we're good at, and you focus on the things that you're good at, which of course is dentistry, and giving the direction for what you're trying to accomplish. And so it is a system that works, and we feel very strongly about it. And the best way to see if it's a system that works for you is, you know, talk to the people that worked with us or done that kind of system, and they're going to say yes, it worked, or no, it didn't. But the majority of them are going to say yes, it worked, and it is a good way of accomplishing it. Okay, I think we've clarified that one as about best as we can. Hopefully, that's the answer to Doctor's question. Let's see. I've got one from a Dr. Michael in Colorado. I'm looking to start a new dental office, and I'm confused. Well, that's good in the sense that we've got someone that's being very straightforward and honest. So the last thing you want to do is is try to hide that you ask those questions. You know, if you're confused, please ask those questions, because not asking is the worst thing you possibly can do. Is a blocking diagram what should be done first? I've been told that this is the best tool to allow me to quickly arrange things the way I want them. Wow, that's a loaded question in the sense of it kind of segues in what we just talked about, hon. But what do you think about what the doctor is asking, you know, should you take a blocking diagram and hand it and say, okay, doc, go create one and then come back?
Well, I think, you know, there's different tools for different organizations to do different things. It depends on what your, you know, what the design professional, are hired to do. If you are, you're starting out and trying to start a practice, naturally, you're going to go through a number of different, you're going to have to put together a number of different pieces, and one of them is finding a location. And when you find a location, it depends on what that location consists of, whether it's located in a commercial office building or a shopping center or standalone building somewhere and so on. But you got to identify whether that particular space or that particular building is going to work for you. So, you know, one of the tools that's used, you know, in the architectural world, we call it the Bobo diagram. But like we say in other episodes, and at least in my experience and Jim's experience as well, those are usually, that particular exercise or tool, the Bobo diagrams, are used for more large, complex type of projects, you know, in the 20, 30, 40,000 square feet and more, with multiple departments and things like that. A dentist's office usually are ranged between, you know, 1,500 square feet, give or take a little, to up to about 5,000 square feet, give or take a few. All right, so it's not a major complicated process. Yeah, you can see, okay, I'm going to use a bubble diagram. You draw a few boxes to see where things is. I think you need more than that, okay? And conceptually, yes, it serves a purpose. But it does not go far enough to answer the real-life questions and answers. Will it work? How will it work? You know, a circle with color doesn't tell you how big, how the furniture, how things going to fit in it. So on a conceptual level, you still got a lot of guessing to do, all right? There's no saying. The devil's in the detail, okay? If you don't have the details to tell you whether that space with all those little boxes, all those little color circles will work or not, you'll find yourself in big trouble when you sign the dotted line to lease the space. And then the compromise happens. Like I say, it's a tool. Is it the best tool? In my opinion, no. The exercise you go through, we call it the feasibility study, you actually block out space. See where the room is, how the traffic's going to flow, whether that room is big enough. There's a lot more than simply placing little Lego pieces in place. There's code that's involved. You know, with its restrictions and requirements that have to be applied into the exercise. Otherwise, you have a piece of paper that may not tell you much of anything except you met your shopping list. I need 7 operatory. I got, you know, a bathroom, a private office, a console room, and a break room, and then yada yada yada, and that may be it. But the detail. So I don't advocate it. I think in my opinion, it's a waste of time. Jim?
Well, it's the goal here. When you first start out is you as the owner, your responsibility is to give to the designer, us, the architect, what your vision of what you'd like to do. And you may not know all of it. So because there's going to be a give and take, there's going to be a question and answer, there's going to be a back and forth. If you don't give us a question or an answer to a question that we know that should be asked, we're going to ask that question. Okay. So that's where that back and forth and that give and take comes from. So one of the first tools that we use, which we think is very important, is the design questionnaire, which goes through all kinds of things having to do with your established practice, how you like to practice, how you want to practice, what you want to do, what you want to accomplish. You know, things like how many operatories do you currently have? How many operatories do you think you want? And then everything else that relates to that, including staff, including just how you function, your hours of operation. How many people do you have working on a particular day and those kind of things? Because that all needs to be integrated into the functionality of the design. And this all comes down to that, the functionality of the design, because if the building doesn't function properly for you to practice dentistry, it's a failure. And it has to be efficient. That's a given. If it's not efficient and you're wasting all kinds of time moving from point A to point B, moving from the front desk to the operatory, or moving from your office space to the operatory, or going back and forth between your hygiene rooms and your clinical operatory spaces where you're working, if you're spending too much time transitioning between all of that, and that's just one factor, and you're just one person, we look at it from all aspects with all the people to be able to give you a very functional space. And it, and on top of functionality, it has to be aesthetically pleasing. It has to be aesthetically pleasing in a lot of ways. It has to be aesthetically pleasing for your patients, to make them comfortable, to give them that first impression that we've talked about before, to be able to have an enjoyable experience and cut down on their anxiety level. But it also has to be aesthetically pleasing and comfortable for your staff and for you, because you guys are spending a long time in this particular building, this space. Your patient might be in there for 45 minutes to an hour. You're in it all day long, and you have to be able to, it has to work, and it has to be a comfortable, enjoyable experience, because that'll translate directly into customer and client experience. But the idea of just saying, okay, the premise of giving you the capability or the idea that you're going to arrange the functionality of the space is the wrong premise. What you need to do is you need to give the information to the designer and the architect. We design the space. We design the functionality, and then we bring it back to you and then give you the tour, and you then say, yes, that is what I was imagining, or no, that's not what I imagined. Now, don't get me wrong, Han, how many times have we seen napkin sketches that have been given to us where a doctor has tried to lay out his space and say, this is how I want to function? Yeah. Almost every other client gives us that kind of thing. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a good tool to start with. But you're not the one that's laying it out. You shouldn't be the one laying it out. You leave that to the professionals that have been doing this for years and years and years and understand the nuances of why things will happen. But remember, I discussed about the issue. There may be questions you don't know. But we're going to ask them. And we're going to ask those questions so that all those bases are covered and that you can, in fact, have the most efficient, the most functionally perfectly flowing space that you can work in, that everyone is happy in, including you, your staff, and, of course, your patients. So I guess I agree with Han in the sense that the idea of a bubble diagram, in my opinion, is an overblown marketing tool that is used to try to get somebody to sign on the dotted line as opposed to a really efficient way to get started. The best way to start, fill out that questionnaire, sit down with your design team, and get an understanding of exactly what you're trying to accomplish, and then let your designer come up with ideas and thoughts that you look at and critique.
Well, let me throw a couple of pieces in there, Jim. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We often we encourage our client, the doctors, to share their vision. What they've been working with, what they would like to work with, what they're looking for, and so on. What I would encourage is this, okay, is that whatever you have in mind, stay flexible. Stay flexible for you, for your staff, you know, for the process, so that ideas can be presented and you're open to analyze it, to assess it, to embrace it. At the end of the day, you make the final decision, okay? You know, the architects and the designer, they can make things happen. They can make magic, you know, appear, but that magic have to work for you. So, you know, the napkin, you know, sketches and things like that, they're fantastic. It started a conversation. But utilize the creativity, the experience and the knowledge of your design team so that you can get the best out of what your investment, you know, is about, rather than you drive the train and basically use them as a drafting service. Okay. There you go, Jim. Next question.
Yeah. What's your next question?
All right. Okay. I have this question.
Oh, by the way,
before you do that,
again, I'd like to remind everybody, these questions come from our listeners. So please go onto our website, www.hjtdesign, and click on the button in there, submit your question, the radio link, and submit your question. You can be anonymous. You can make up a name. It doesn't matter. We're here to answer those questions, and that's what makes this show fun. We're trying to do this at least once a month, if not more. And so the more questions that come in, the more we'll do this. But go ahead, hon.
Yeah, I want to remind you, listeners, that our mantra is the only dumb question is the one you don't ask.
Yeah.
Right? So ask away. Right? This is the question from Dr. Andrew from Toledo, Ohio. It's a city official wanted me to include a drinking fountain in my office building. Is there any way around that? What's your thought, Jim?
Oh, man. All right. The city official, I'm assuming it's the building official, and the building official,
yes,
who is charged with one thing and only one thing, and that's making sure that the building is built to the current code that has been basically written into law in that particular state. Each state has a different code, and sometimes they're even augmented by cities, where cities have additional codes that require all kinds of things. And it all comes around having to do with a multitude of government bureaucracy that deals with everything. But it started back with life safety. Life safety was the overall crux of where code started. And I'll do a little quick history, but you know, back before there were codes, there were all kinds of buildings being built out of all kinds of different materials, with some with lesser degree than others with issues of safety. And we had major things like, you know, the Chicago fire, terrible things that came about from like the earthquake up in Alaska, those kind of things where massive amounts of the cities were burnt to the ground. So that started the whole thing with codes, in a sense that, you know, life safety is important. These are public buildings. And so the government had to do something about it and started creating that. So they've morphed into these very restrictive minimum sets of standards that are required for your specific area to wherever you're building. So if your building code, specifically the plumbing side of it, says that you need to have, and it's usually in the plumbing side where it says you need to have this many water closets, you need to have these many urinals, these many sinks, this many slop sink, which is basically a mop basin, and you need to have drinking fountains. That's the law. That's the requirement for that particular building and that particular building use. Now, does the building official have the authority to change that? And the answer is no. He doesn't, or she doesn't. And I have not ever heard of a building official who will stick their neck out and do that. Maybe few and far between, but we've never dealt with one that would do that in the sense of, well, because you know, whatever reason, we're going to let you slide on this aspect. Nope, that won't happen. Don't count on it. Now, there could be room for interpretation. And we have sometimes been successful in discussing the practicalities of the requirements, and especially things like drinking fountains. I'm not talking about things like, well, you need to have 5 water closets and you only want to put in 3. Forget it. Code says 5, you're going to put in 5, or you're not going to get your building approved. But in regards to a drinking fountain, there have been some times where we've been successful in discussing it with the building official to get a waiver, in the sense that bottled water, which is readily available, either self-serve or that kind of stuff, could be used in lieu of a drinking fountain. But that's on a case-by-case basis, and don't expect it to be a given.
Let me throw one, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, from time to time, you know, the argument, and, you know, because they become argument a lot of time, because the building owner goes, but, you know, my friend Bob, the dentist down the street, didn't have a drinking fountain in his office. You know, for us, we don't have an answer, but I can offer you one. If Bob is 100 years old and his building is about 100 years old, likelihood he won't have a drinking fountain in his office. The code change. It changed, Germany did every 3 or 6 years.
Both. There are amendments and there are changes, and they could happen. It could happen as many as, you know, every 3 years. Now, it's an extensive process to change a code, and it's something that it's not easy, and it's very difficult and laborious. So that's why it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. New codes come out and new codes change. So over the years, if you're looking at a building that's even maybe 10 or 15 years older than yours, it could have been done under a different code, which might have had different criteria than what you have today. One of the biggest one that's just changed lately has to do with the fresh air levels, the fresh air intake levels within your building. It has been, this is happening around the country, where the fresh air intake levels have increased drastically. Because a lot of things, and it's been found that there's been not enough fresh air within the buildings themselves, so they've increased it, the minimum requirement. So,
and I think it's because as technology advances, building material become become too good. The building becomes too tight, so that the natural air exchange from leakage in your building to the outdoor and stuff like that become less and less. So you are breathing, you're breathing in the same exhaust air that you're breathing out, and people are becoming sick. So the change in the mechanical system and the air exchange rate become, you know, greater because of that. But let me get back. So in term of the code, is that it almost happened practically, it happened from time to time where we work on a project and the project, we have to be conscious that the new code come into effect on this date. Okay. Our objective is to actually finish the project, submit it for permit before the new code get adapted. Okay. So code, when the code change, your friend who did the building last year may not need to have a certain particular fixture, but your project being built this year under the new code will require that. So you have to take all that into consideration, not just simply why others don't have and why do I have to. Okay. Like Jim mentioned, the building official only they have to adhere to the minimum requirement of the code. They can't change it. The code do have exceptions and alternatives. In other words, we have worked in the municipality where as long as you provide instead of a drinking fountain, and you have a beverage station, and that beverage station have potable, dedicated potable spigot, not the sink, okay? Don't be a smart aleck and say, here, let me give my patient a cup and they can go into the bathroom and get out of the sink. That doesn't work. So you have to provide potable water that they can serve themselves. Some would say, well, I provide, refrigerator with small bottle of bottled water behind the front desk. Well, you can remove that anytime. You can discontinue that, providing that anytime, and that had happened. So that's why usually they won't deviate from a drinking fountain that's hard plumb in, or some people call it bubbler, but it is a water dispenser that's hard plumb in, okay? Because people do try to skirt around the code. Again, like Jim said, you can present your case, but the success rate is pretty, pretty small.
Yep.
Next question, Jim.
Yep, let's go to the next one. We got a Dr. John from New Hampshire. We haven't had one from there for a while. Well, that's cool. I'm scared about all the issues that others have told me about. During building of a new office, things like delays, cost overruns, and just basically the high stress environment that it creates. What do you guys recommend? Oh, boy. Go ahead, Han. We only have 12 minutes.
Which one do we want to go first? Let's say overrun in time. Okay. This is, I think, in one or two episodes ago, I expressed this. There's things that we manage, and there's things that we can control. Okay. We can manage time, we can manage costs. We can't control them. There's things that happen in the course of the design that require more time. There's things that occur during the construction time that require more time. For instance, if the client have not purchased or agreed to purchase and or selected equipment for the office, or decided on a delivery system and where it's going to go, or the X-ray unit, where it's going to go. Every little thing that, every piece of information, every little thing that are needed, every decision that's needed to be provided to the team that the team's not getting to continue their work will delay the project. Okay? In the construction side, weather is one is something that nobody have control over. You can work around it, but let's say for the fluke of this during the season, you get, you know, 4 rainy days out of the week when you're trying to get a building up. You know, building from the ground up, you have more risk because the weather. And that's why it's usually you try to enclose the building as quickly as possible. You celebrate every day when the sun shines. That's why Florida is a great state to do this in. Okay? That's just a plug for Florida, Jim. Delay, yeah.
Except during
delay,
hurricane.
That's right. But then you can build new. Okay? But, you know, delay and on time overrun, we can only you try to manage that as best as we can. Jim, you want to give a shot at for money?
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
cost overruns and stress. All of those things come from, actually, all of the things that the doctor was scared of come from a poorly managed project. And probably, more than likely, the system that his friends that told him about it that they were using or they experienced had poorly managed projects. So you need to bring on a professional, specifically one who knows dentistry and knows dental design and knows dental construction and has years and years of experience dealing with it, to minimize all of those factors. And that includes cost overruns and high stress issues and things like delays. You'll never eliminate all of them, but you can put into place a system that's going to hopefully get rid of most of them. So you have just a few, and then there's a system in place with your professional design team that when something comes up, you have the flexibility in there. So the team is factored in enough time for some delays in weather. The team is factored in enough time for you, the doctor, not to respond as quickly as you should. Or they have a system in place saying, Doc, it's been 2 weeks. We need an answer. You know, that kind of thing, as opposed to just let it going on and on and on forever, because that could be disastrous for a schedule. And, you know, everyone working together as a team with the right team leader, again, you know, we say that's us, with you being the owner of the project and we're the quarterback. So that makes the most sense. It's what we're basically trained to do, and it helps for minimizing all of these issues. Where we've seen historically in the past where things really get screwed up and go astray is when someone else takes over the lead or thinks they should take over the lead. Like when the general contractor thinks that they should do it their way and not follow the system, or the another entity within the team decides, no, we're going to do it this way and we're not going to follow the protocol, so that, you know, no one knows what's happening. We've seen it, and it happens all the time, doesn't it, Han, where, you know, someone's doing something that doesn't let the other people know, and so the coordination is screwed up, and next thing you know, when they go to put the equipment in, crap, the utilities aren't lined up where they should be. And so it's like, oh, there's no blocking in the wall to hang that x-ray unit. Or, you know, just all those kind of things which add to the delays and potentially to cost overruns and definitely to the stress level. So understand your idea of being scared from the horror stories that you're out there, but keep in mind, you hire the professional who understands this system and understands this process, you'll be long on your way to be able to have a much better experience, and one that's a whole lot less stressful, and also one that is doesn't have as many delays in it and doesn't have the issue with cost overruns. None of us can predict the weather, but a whole lot of other things should be able to be managed and managed well. Hanna, do we have enough time for you to jump in for one more question? You got a short one? Did I miss you, Han? Did I lose you?
Jim?
Yeah, go ahead. Do you have one quick question? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I do. Okay. This is from Dr. Andrea from New Jersey. I have heard that once I receive my certificate of occupancy, I can change things that I don't really want in my office. What's your thought?
Oh, that's right up there with the drinking fountain, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. In a nutshell, my response to that as a licensed architect, the response is, no, you can't. And by law, if you tell me that you have done that, I have a responsibility to report you as a licensed architect in the state. It's no different than a officer of the court has a responsibility to report a crime. It's the same kind of thing. So my recommendation as a professional licensed architect is don't do it. And without a doubt, don't tell me about it.
I'll let you
finish that thought.
Because I'm curious, okay, because I hear from time to time, and I like to hear from the building official. So I reach out to, you know, to building official that I know well, that I trust, and I ask that same question, and the explanation to me was the document that we call the construction document or the drawings that are approved and for use to build your office, or whether your office building, is a legal contract between you, the building owner, and the city. So the things that are called out shown on the drawing, especially things that are pertinent to code, like plumbing fixtures, drinking fountains, mop sink, and things like that. Those are code items, okay?
Door swings. We've heard about, you know, people talk about, well, I don't like the way that door swings, so I'll change it afterwards. But no.
Yeah.
There's a reason why that door has to swing that way.
Or simply go, I do not like door levers. I'm going to put it in turn, you know, going to change to knob. Those simple little changes violates the building code. Okay? So, but what he say, you know, what the code official say is that when you make that change, that make that omission after the certificate occupancy, is that you willingly, knowingly breach the contract between you and the city. And what is the consequences? Okay? They can shut you down until you fix it. They might find you. Okay? So, like Jim say, and I will back Jim up. No, don't do it. It's not worth it. I mean, you pay for it. It was designed properly. It should function, service you based on what's required of the code. It's very much like of the regulatory things that you're required when you're providing services, dental health services to your patient. If you skip any of the protocol in terms of infection control and stuff like that, it could be a really, really bad thing. So your building is designed with certain criteria, certain requirements, and COVID-related stuff. I recommend you leave it alone. I don't care how many of your peers have done it, okay? They're not the expert. They're probably not going to bring the cake with the with the saw blade to rescue you. All right, just don't.
Well, one of the big ones, Han. Here's a big one that I've seen, and I see it so many times. Let's say your door is a fire rated door and it has an automatic closure on it. So it's designed to separate one space from another space. And that door needs to be closed and stay closed unless it's being used by someone moving in and out. And then the next thing you know, you see somebody prop that baby open and stick a wedge in it in the bottom to hold it in place. And so it's propped open all the time. All the time. That is a break in the code. And if something were to happen, if there were a fire, if there was an emergency and someone got killed or injured, guess who's responsible for that? You are.
The building owner
is directly responsible for that, and you will be held personally liable for that incident. And so, don't do those things. If it's designed to be able to be to have a door closer and to be a fire rated door, don't prop it open. It's no different than on double doors. And this is the biggest pet peeve of mine. Oh my, I just get so ticked off every time I walk in. It doesn't happen as much in dental offices as it does in other retail establishments and those kind of stuff. When you have a pair of double doors and one door is always locked.
Yeah.
So we're American. We come in the right side and we go out the right side and we go out the right side. Right. Well,
right.
When you lock that one door, which happens to be the right side when you're walking out, you effectively are reducing the width of that exit by 50%. If that door requirement for exiting is for the whole width of two doors, you've just broke the law. And if something happens within your building and they're even as simple as somebody, yells fire when there is no fire, or as simple as some kid pulls the fire alarm and sets off the sprinkler system or whatever, and all of a sudden there's a panic and people are running to the front door and only one of them works, someone's going to get hurt. And worse yet, someone might get killed. Don't do it, please. And every time you walk through, I like to be a personal advocate of this. Every time I walk through a situation when there's a door like that's open, and it's not open, it's locked, I'll click those buttons and I'll unlock that door and make sure it stays unlocked before I walk out. My wife looks at me and says, "You just did that, didn't you?" And I says, "You're darn right I did." And if there isn't a way for me to open it as I'm walking out, I go to the manager and I say, "Excuse me, that door needs to be opened." And if you don't believe me, talk to your building official. 9 times out of 10, you see them scurry their little bottoms up to the front door and unlock it.
You and I have very similar peeves. What Jim is describing happens a lot in a retail facility, particularly grocery store that opens late at night.
Yeah.
Okay. That would include, I'm going to throw a name. Kroger, Walmart are two that are, and those are the two that I've seen done often because they open late. Walmart open 24/7. Right on the door, it say this door shall remain unlocked and operational as long as this building is open for business and or occupied. Until you walk up to it and you go, dang it, they lock it, all right? They just violated the law, okay?
Yeah.
So when it comes to, you know, when it comes to adhering to the code and to the laws and regulatory requirements, stuff like that, it's better to be on the side of the good guys, all right? It's a lot cheaper, and you have more freedom to do the rest of the stuff that you love.
Yeah, definitely.
Jim?
Well, obviously, you know, Han and I are passionate about this stuff. We wouldn't be wasting your time and ours as well. You know, this stuff is fun. We're excited about it. Hopefully it's been educational. Please, you know, feel free to submit your questions. Go to our website. You know, submit your questions, ask any question you'd like, and we'll do everything we can to answer it. And with that, we just want to thank you for being part of our show tonight, and look forward to the next opportunity we get to do another one of these. So, Han, I'll let you have the last word.
Well, I appreciate you plugging in with us and spend the hour with us. I hope you learned something. I at least hope you enjoy, the episode. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.